love them as kids, but man, do they really stink as we get older. It's the top five movies we loved as kids, but we can't. But they don't stand the test of time. This is Top 5. I'm Stephen Schleicher. Sure. Joining me this week is Matthew Peterson and Rodrigo Lopez. Hello, Rodrigo.
Hey.
So, Matthew, why don't you kick us off with a movie that you loved as a kid, but man, today, what were you thinking?
Oh, there's a lot of those. It should be noted that I was a weird kid. I was when I was young, I was very apparently grown up and adulty and didn't act like a kid.
What happened?
Didn't do the things that kid did. I don't know. But when I was 9 years old, I watched this movie on cable at my mother's house. And I was like, this is really awesome. I'm going to watch this over and over. And of course, HBO being what it was in 1980, you could, in fact, watch it over and over and over. And I really, really liked this movie. It was an awesome movie. And I realize now today that it was a ripoff of Smokey and the Bandit in many ways. But it featured Diane Cannon as this super rich woman who runs away from her husband after he commits her and ends up in a truck with Beretta. Robert Blake. It's called Coast to Coast. It is ostensibly a comedy. Now, I've seen this movie in my adulthood, and as with many of the things that I liked when I was 9 and 10, my first thought process was I high? But it is supposed to be a comedy, supposed to be a romance, even though the main characters have no chemistry whatsoever. And of course, it follows that Smokey and the Bandit, you know, woman runs away and ends up with this rebel drivey guy who drives and things. And there's also some attempted murder and lots of poop jokes. It apparently won a Golden Raspberry Award. I didn't know that that was a thing until today when we were getting ready for this show. But Coast to Coast from 1980 is a movie that I remember loving and thinking it was really great and really adult and really sophisticated. And it is effing awful.
Okay, cool. So I have talked before that one of my favorite movies of all time is The Karate Kid with Ralph Macchio and Pat Morita.
Mm-hmm. Sweep the leg, Johnny.
Yeah, man, it's a really good movie. Still
put
a really
in a
good
body
movie.
Bag.
Really holds up today, too. Regardless, there's really no need to make a remake of that movie.
I agree.
But in 1986, there was The Karate Kid Part 2. And this time, they're going to Okinawa. Mr. Miyagi's father is dying or has died, and he has to go back and face the community that he once left and face the guy that's a big...
Sato, the
big guy on campus. And at the time, everybody was like, yeah, this is a really good movie. This may be even better than the Karate Kid movie. And I watched it many, many, many times as a kid growing up on the VHS, at friends' houses, on the HBOs, on wherever it was playing at.
Yeah.
And I watched it about a month and a half ago. That movie really sucks.
Features Tamlyn Tomita in
one of
her roles, though.
Yeah.
I like her.
Yeah, oh no, I mean, it's still got, it's got some great actors in it, but...
And Ralph Macchio.
But the story, the premise, a lot of the, it's like shot on a soundstage, a lot of it. Like, they built the whole town. I mean, there's some exteriors in this town, but like stuff where the stunt work goes on in the main square, it's like, oh, this is all a soundstage, and it looks really bad.
That final tsunami sequence feels like it's all on a soundstage.
Yeah, it's just a movie that I watched. I was like, really? I got a big kick out of this when I was a kid, but not so much today. So The Karate Kid Part 2 on my number 5.
It's Rodrigo, better than The Karate Kid Part 3.
Oh, yeah, definitely better than... But that movie was not good to begin with.
But that's not the point. It's,
and then there's,
on a scale.
And then there is The New Karate Kid, which is actually better than, I would say The New Karate Kid is as good or better than Karate Kid Part 2. So, yeah. Rodrigo, what do you have for your number 5?
My number 5 is at number 5 because it's not a movie that I loved as a kid, but it's a movie that I watched a lot as a kid. You know, when you're little and you don't necessarily have access to a lot of movies, you end up watching the same stuff over and over again.
Right.
So for me, this movie I ended up watching a lot. This is The Care Bears Movie 2. Care Bears Movie 2, A New Generation.
Now, wait, let me ask. Are you the oldest?
I am the oldest, yes.
Okay, so your sister is in the middle?
Yes.
So was this her doing, or was this you really literally had nothing to do?
No. The thing is, like, the way that kids in Mexico tend to come into these movies is by having relatives go to flea market type things and getting them, and they're either actual imports or they're knockoffs, basically. So we had this like really low quality copy of it that we got somehow. And it was just a thing where it's like, well, this is 1986. Assuming that we got it within 3 years of that, I was still pretty little. So they were probably not like, I definitely did have relatives who were like, men should like trucks and soccer balls and stuff.
Oh, no. The reason I ask is because my sister was that way, too. It was like she had the Care Bears and the Strawberry Shortcake movie stuff. And so if it was her wanting to watch something, which she did want to watch stuff over and over again, I usually had to sit through it because there was only one TV in the house, and that was it. So,
yeah, go ahead.
Is this the one where the bear turns to the audience and makes us clap for Tinkerbell?
Yes, it is.
I've seen this one.
There's two Care Bear movies, apparently, at least two. And for the longest time, I didn't realize that this was the second movie. In fact, my girlfriend made me watch a part of the first movie. And I'm like, yeah, I've seen the Care Bears movie. And it was a completely different, also terrible Care Bears movie. And it wasn't until I saw this as an adult that two things happened. One, I understood the songs because now I could speak English and the songs didn't get translated. And two, it's like there's just something about the Care Bears where it's like it just seems like it's a bunch of adults that obviously their main goal is to sell toys, but they're like, we have to, it's almost like they feel guilty about selling these toys to children. So they make it so like saccharine and like over the top, like let's all be good people to each other kind of stuff, to the point where it's like not even believable. I don't know. Obviously unbelievable as far as character growth, not right. In the fact that there are magical bears and horses and lions
that live in the sky
that basically have guns in their bellies. The coolest part about them, which gets barely any play. So yes, my number five, The Care Bears Movie 2.
Ooh, all right. Wow. Matthew, what do you have for number four?
My number four is a movie that deeply hurt me many times over many years. And the reason this happened is because, again, as a child, I was, you know, I was not really aware of pop culture below the age of about 10 or 11 years old. And when I started becoming aware of it, as you may have noticed, my brain has a tendency to just go, bruh, eat all and remember. So I had seen the television show, which spawned this movie many, many times on Sunday mornings. And I'm like, ooh, they're making a movie of it. And I happened to be a nerd who read books. And I got the novelization, and because I read the novelization before I saw the movie, my brain was willing to fill in the blanks of this movie and make this movie work when I finally got to see it on cable. But after one or two different, you know, airings, and I'm like, okay, well, this is going really slow, I started to realize that my number four, Star Trek, the motion picture, known in my household as Star Trek, the motionless picture, is the slowest movie ever made. And that sentence is really an example of how the whole movie goes. Everything in it feels like a pale shadow of Star Trek, the television series. All of the characters are bland. Nobody has any real moments of brilliance. There's none of the humor. none of the stuff. There's literally no conflict in the movie to speak of because it's this weird alien race from another world. All the costumes are these weird pastels. And even though they have a movie budget and movie special effects, that's really what the movie seems to be about. The version that I remember seeing was super long, like 2 hours and 20 minutes. And if you chopped a good 20 minutes out of that movie, you'd still have a way too long film, but it would be structurally stronger. And when you see it on television now, it really is one of those moments where you're like, okay, the only reason they ever play this film is because Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II, will be up next. So I'll come back in 2 hours and 10 minutes. Because Star Trek The Motionless Picture is just dull. It has a nice, you know, scary boing at the end like Rod Serling, but it's kind of weak sauce Rod Serling. And even Spock, even Leonard Nimoy in full-on alien eyebrow pointiness can't bring this thing to life. So it hurt me. It did. And really, it's probably the Star Trek movie that hurt me the most until I saw Star Trek Into Darkness some 30 years later. So, you know, when Star Trek, your old friend, your pal, your buddy, hurt you that badly, of course, there's really no choice but to watch the movie a dozen times and come back in 2 years when they make a sequel. Because, you know, that's what we do.
The last time I watched Star Trek The Motion Picture was probably 22 years ago, something like that. It was airing on regular broadcast television, and I had to go to work at the radio station. And that whole sequence where they're flying up to the Enterprise and everything and docking. I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, oh, come on. This movie's got to go. That whole thing ran for 20 minutes. Ran the length of time from one commercial break to the other commercial break was the giant space shot. And at the end of that space shot, it was back to commercial. I was like, oh, my God. This is the last time I remember watching this movie. And turned it off, went to work, and have not watched it since.
If you watch it on commercial television, it's literally like a 3 hour experience with commercial breaks.
Yeah. And oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm not willing to devote that much time to anything that doesn't, you know, involve dessert these days. And it's just, oh, I remember the first couple of times I watched it, I was like, yeah, Star Trek on TV. And then I'm like, Star Trek. Oh, wait. Oh, okay. And now I'm just sad and old and depressed.
Aw. That's okay. Well, maybe my number four will make you feel a little bit better, Matthew.
Is it worse than Star Trek The Motionless Picture?
Oh, yeah, I think so. In hindsight, yes. At the time, it was pretty cool because we're high off of E.T. We're high off of, you know, all these space movies and Space Invaders movies
high
and
off of
aliens.
That rubber cement that we
high off. The, yes. From building my Klingon warship model. Yes. the movie had, you know, Dee Wallace in it that we know from E.T. It had Emmett Walsh. It even had Billy Zane in the movie, of all people.
The Phantom?
And it is a story about these space eggs that come down and hatch. And these little furry aliens eating and devouring and killing everyone. They shoot these little spines off their back. Oh, it was a horrifying, frightening movie. It's scary. I remember, because it was whatever year it was, my mom went to go see it with me. And she was like freaked out at the end. It was a lot of fun. But oh man, today if you watch that movie, it is horrible. The acting is terrible. Even M. Emmett Walsh does not save the movie. Dee Wallace, all she does is just scream the entire time. Billy Zane was just a kid at this point. But it was not a good movie. It's still not a good movie. And if anyone says, hey, what do you think of this Critters? I would say avoid it. It's got like punk rock aliens that come down from outer space that are hunting these critters.
Punk rock aliens. Oh, they look so fine.
You know, they don't. Today, they look laughable. It's about as watching that movie today is about as laughable as watching Bonk and Skull do their antics on Power Rangers.
That back.
An interesting comparison, seeing as how I would say it's the opposite. Like Bulk and Skull's antics are actually not funny.
Okay, yes. It would be the equivalent of that, but backwards, sure. So that is my number four, Critters. from 1988. It seems you remember that came out before that. Yeah. Okay. 86. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember Critters on VHS. Never watched it.
Yeah. No.
Came out. There was Critters and Ghoulies and.
Yep.
They were basically all knockoffs of Gremlins, is what mm-hmm. they felt like.
Yeah. That's exactly what Critters was, but creatures from outer space. Mm-hmm. Yep. Rodrigo, what do you have for number four?
My number four was my first. The first time I encountered something that was adapted from something I liked, and that thing had nothing to do with that thing. Masters of the Universe, 1987, is a movie that as a kid, I liked it. But even as a kid, I remember my parents took me to see it in the theaters, and I was like, how was that He-Man? And they were like, well, like He-Man was there and Skeletor was there. I was like, yeah, but that was the only thing. Like, even as a little kid, I was like, that was weird. And I didn't hate it, but I was like, why would they call it He-Man if it's not going to be like, why is He-Man hanging out with these other people that aren't like a bug person and a guy whose head flips around, you know?
Modulok.
Yeah. So it was an interesting experience for me going back and seeing it again. It's not good. Interestingly, it took me this long to realize that basically Masters of the Universe kind of has a sequel, and that's the Mario Brothers movie. Like, it's the same kind of movie, right?
Yeah,
it's like you can see whatever dimension the Masters of the Universe comes from is actually the past of the Mario Brothers dimension, where also nothing has anything to do with the source material.
That's funny. They are making a sequel, or they're remaking the movie.
Yeah.
So you've got that to look forward to.
We'll see how that goes.
We'll see if it's a little bit better. Yeah, probably not. Matthew, what do you have for your number, what are we up to, three?
Three. Our number threes, I think, are probably where it's going to start getting real. So, you know, buckle your safety belts, faithful spoilerites. My number three is a movie that, honestly, when you say doesn't stand the test of time, isn't because of quality. It isn't because of the acting. It isn't necessarily because the underlying story is disappointing or the adaptation is bad or everybody's wearing a light brown jumpsuit in space. It's a movie that, when it came out in 1984, was meant to be wild and raucous and raunchy, but in the year 2016, is awful and abusive and super rapey. And that movie is Revenge of the Nerds.
Oh, yeah.
I loved this movie when I was a kid. I still have affection for this movie, for parts of it. Gilbert and Lewis, that whole sequence where they take over the talent show and Wormser and Lamar come out and demonstrate what great dancers they are and everybody's super talented and the people are like, oh, maybe these nerds are okay. And then they go and they're in the whole talent competition or the sports competition and they use their brains to overcome the things against them. And what they do ends up being horrible, and they end up basically assaulting all of the popular girls. And it, from the perspective of a grown man, what the nerds do may actually be worse than the jocks who, you know, throw them out of the dorm and beat them up and wreck their stuff. At least they're not, you know, attacking someone's civil liberties. They're not, you know, recording underage people in their nudity. It's a movie that has a lot of problems. So today, in retrospect, if you could cut out or change any and all of the portions of the movie having to deal with the alpha pies, the pretty girls, and maybe alter the way that Lewis ends up meeting and wooing his girlfriend, this movie would still be perfectly fine. This is good movie.
No, look at how they treat the homosexuals are portrayed.
Well, but this is, I mean, yes, I agree. That is a very stereotypical character.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of characters who are super creepy. You know, the little Jewish kid is super Jewish.
Uh-huh.
And when you go through it, what the movie is trying to tell us is all of these people, no matter where they come from, are still people inside. And what it ends up saying is, and that means they're equally awful. And that's why I, in parlance, deal with my number three, a movie that I dearly loved that I still have some heart for, Revenge of the Nerds. And don't even talk to me about Revenge of the Nerds 2.
Yeah, no, those movies, I mean, the first one was the best of all of them.
Fight you but over the, Revenge of the Nerds 2.
That is definitely a movie that is a product of its time period, mm-hmm. when everything in there was acceptable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But or, man, today you just look at it and it's just cringeworthy.
Well, and you know, the thing about it is I never thought that I could say this, but Porky's has actually aged better than Revenge of the Nerds.
Mm.
And part of that is because Porky's is a 50s period piece. And so they're dealing with, you know, things, 50s stuff from the perspective of the 70s. And you get to have characters seeming like they're way ahead of the curve socially and morally. But yeah, Revenge of the Nerds just kind of falls apart in the third act because our heroes become just terrible people.
Yeah.
That's really the worst thing a lot of the time. I don't know if you've ever sat down with somebody who hasn't seen a movie and you're like, I remember this movie being great. You're going to love it. And you start watching it and there's like something about it and you were like, oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Yes, I completely forgot it. Oh my God, please don't think that I love that.
Yeah, no, that is the worst. That is the worst feeling. That has definitely happened to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. My number three is a movie that came out in 1957, but I saw it as a kid on Saturday afternoon matinee and it scared
Shuttle
the crap
41.
Out of me. Actually, yeah, maybe CBS, whatever the CBS Friday, no, the Saturday sci-fi thing that they would run after cartoons on CBS. Mm. It wasn't on 41. It was definitely on CBS. But I was introduced to a I guess it's a horror movie. Oh, no, science fiction movie is what it is. The Monolith Monsters. And this is one that even up until probably 15 years ago, if I saw it, it would freak me out. It's about this meteorite thing. And this is really weird. This is the weirdest movie you'll ever see. Meteorite crashes to Earth, and these fragments that survive start behaving weirdly. If they come into contact with water, they start to grow to immense sizes and start, you know, just crushing down on everything. It starts to petrify people who are near these rocks. And in the end, I forget how I think it was salt water or something that causes them to crumple and be deactivated. But as a kid, it scared me to death. And every time it would come on, it was one of those movies where I was scared to watch it, but I would always watch it to get the scare out of me.
Mm-hmm.
But today, this is a 1957. Keep in mind, this is a 1957 sci-fi horror film.
Yeah.
The Monolith Monsters, about giant rocks. Acting, Grant Williams, Lola Albright, not the greatest acting for even that time period. Mm-hmm. And the premise is totally stupid. And it's not even scary anymore. I'm not scared of any black rocks that I see laying on the ground. In fact, I defy them. I now pick them up openly and mock them. Ah, ha, ha. Where's the petrification now?
Poo at you, rocks.
Yes.
I'm full of salt water.
Yes. So the Monolith Monsters, just not a good movie.
With all the beer Steven drinks, he's 40% salt
I'm
water.
40% alcohol.
Where's your God now, Monolith Monsters?
And then they silently fall over and crush my house. Rodrigo, what do you have for number three?
My number three is a movie that I saw a lot. Basically, when I was a kid, there was a video rental place that was pretty close to my house. So every once in a while, I'd go ask my parents if they would like spot me some money to go rent a movie. And there were a few that I rented a lot. And this was one of them. It was a movie that I really liked. And for the life of me, I can't tell you what the plot actually is, but I'm guessing it has something to do with some like corrupt government official or like scary guy trying to exploit the protagonist's super cute pets. This movie is Prehysteria, which is a movie about a bunch of tiny dinosaurs.
Yes.
It's tiny like dinosaurs. This like preteen boy finds a bunch of tiny dinosaurs and names them all after entertainers. And here's the reason why I feel this movie doesn't hold up, because the dinosaurs are named like Elvis, Jagger, Madonna, and then like one of them is like Paula, and I'm like, you know, in 1993, maybe looking back, you might think, yeah, Paula Abdul stands with the greats, but in 2016, looking back, you might say, well, who's that? It's like, you know, the jury's still out. Will, if they made this movie today, would there be a dinosaur named Gaga? And, you know, 20, 30 years later, would people still say, yep, I'd recognize why that dinosaur is called that?
I only know this movie by reputation because all of the dinosaurs are voiced by Frank Welker. I've never actually seen it, but I know that if you look up Frank Welker, it's like, yeah, he was all seven of the dinosaurs in this pre-hysteria movie.
Yeah, the thing is like, this movie is just, for a movie about tiny dinosaurs, which is what I liked about it, this movie is just like scoop after scoop of vanilla, right? It's just like, this kid finds these dinosaurs. Oh, dad, no, they're going to dissect them if we let them loose. Okay, we can keep them. Ha, 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 hijinks around the house. Probably some kind of music montage where they're getting up to trouble. Some guy's trying to get them so he can exploit them. In the end, there's like a farcical thing where it's like, oh, no, my dinosaurs. And then they get away. You know, I mean, it's like we've seen this movie a trillion times.
And yeah.
Seeing this movie again, I'm just like, there is nothing here. Except for tiny dinosaurs, tiny puppet dinosaurs, which actually look really good. So in that sense, it does kind of stand up. But in the sense that this is the same movie that we've seen every day since E.T. Uh-huh. And in that the musical references as far as like where they sit in the pantheon of rock and roll are kind of strange. it, you know, otherwise it's okay.
Excellent. What was the title again?
Pre-Hysteria. Oh, there was actually at least one sequel.
Really?
There's like four of them, and they made them all in the space of like 6 months.
And you can imagine. So this movie was straight to video.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. So this movie was straight to video, and then they made a bunch of sequels after it. Can you imagine what the quality of those sequels must be?
Well, if you take into account the law of diminishing returns and the 30% minimum downgrade from each sequel, ooh, by that third or fourth movie, we're going to be scraping the bottom of the barrel.
But that by like the third movie, I'm sure they were just like actual sock puppets.
Hey guys, how's it going? Oh dear!
Excellent. All right, Matthew, what do you have for your number two?
My number two comes from the far-flung year 1985. When I was a young lad, my life as a reader and a person was changed by the discovery of a book in the possession of my friend Stork, who didn't read a lot, and so him having a book was noteworthy. And the book itself was super noteworthy. The book was The Night Shift, Stephen King's collection of short stories. And I've mentioned before, I love King short stories. I can take or leave much of his novel-length efforts, but when he's forced to pare it down and do a short story with a stinger at the end, Stephen King can write some mean stories. So in 1985, when the stories from Night Shift were being adapted into movie form, I'm like, oh, holy carp, we need to go and check this out. This ought to be interesting. And so, ooh, there's my microphone. I thought I'd lost it for a moment. And so I went to see this movie, and I thought, ooh, this is great. Look at that, all that, ooh, it's special effects and action and scary. Oh, no, somebody died. A guy fell off a building. And then I didn't see it for many years. And maybe a year, year and a half ago, I'm sitting up on a Friday night like you do. It happened on a TBS showing of Cat's Eye.
Oh, yeah, I remember this, yes.
And my God, that movie stunk on ice.
Had the little troll thing.
Yeah, I would rather be poisoned slowly than watch this movie again. And this is, you know, this is a movie with some good bits and pieces to it. The Ledge, which is one of King's best stories.
That's the one that I remember most.
But The Ledge has a really killer ending in the book that they changed for the movie because it's another one of King's you figure it out for yourself, think about what happens or imagine what happens O. Henry things. And they gave it a comedy ending with a literal ha ha horn at the end. And then Quitters Inc., which has a really dark premise and one of the darkest stingers I've ever seen in any story ever. And it's done by the guy, the main character is played by the guy from Airplane. So you watch this and it's this dark story about a man going to any length to quit smoking. And I just see him sitting there going, I have a drinking problem.
Splash.
Yes, exactly. But it gets really, really bad in the third segment with a very, very young, like a 7-year-old Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
And the cat's eye is actually about this cat. And the cat has been like walking through the first two stories. And in the third story, the cat is having a fight with this little troll who looks kind of like one of them critters.
Well, that's what I thought the whole point was. The cat was trying to get back to the little girl because he knew the troll thing was going to kill her. And that's how he interacted with the other two stories.
See, and that's the thing. It's not entirely clear in the story whether the cat knows where he's going. At the end, the cat has a loving home. You're like, yay, cat. But oh my God, that third segment is just not.
The effects are not good at all.
Not even 30 years ago, I would look at those effects and go, guys. But again, you know, I'm a fan of Doctor Who from that same time period. And there are times when your green screens are funny and your proto computer effects are funny. But, you know, it has some nice pseudo miniature work where they built a giant fan. A little wall fan. But cannot for the life of me see what I saw in that movie other than the fact that I was so enamored of those two stories when I read them that, again, my brain brought so much to this movie experience that it was like filling in blanks and not realizing how big and numerous and vast those blanks were. So if you get a chance to watch King's 80s movies, I say don't. Because Silver Bullet is
Christine
crap. Christine, okay, watch Christine. That's Carpenter. John Carpenter can make a scary movie out of a kettle and some string.
What's the one with the Green Goblin trucks that
that's Maximum Overdrive.
Maximum Overdrive.
Don't walk away from
Stand By Me.
Turn and walk. Okay, you can watch Stand By Me.
Yeah, all the Stephen King movies are awful.
You can
Cujo.
Watch Stand By Me. You can watch Shawshank Redemption.
No, that didn't come out in the '80s though.
I don't care.
Cujo, that came out in the '80s. Pet Sematary.
Don't watch Cujo. You will never, ever look at Dee Wallace Stone the same.
Oh, yes, you will, because you'll watch her in Critters and go, what? What is this Dee Wallace Stone thing? Stop it!
Yeah, this is not a good movie. And, you know,
we found the nexus of our problems with these movies, Matthew.
Stephen King?
Dee Wallace Stone.
I will say
Let's
this.
Let's just
Stephen
look
King
at her IMDb.
Has gone on record as saying about his 80s movie output, and this is paraphrasing, but relatively true. Yeah, I was stoned. And
yeah.
It really shows in the final product, especially Maximum Overdrive, but also my number three, Cat's Eye, which has some wonderful cat stunt training. It does have that. Because, you know, we have a cat in the house and you can't train a cat. But these guys apparently got the cats to do what they wanted in ways that were good on television. So that's fun.
There you go. All right. My number two I've talked about before and saying that I actually loved it as a kid. It's a time travel movie. Mm-hmm. It is a funny sci-fi comedy. It came out in the same year as Back to the Future, Real Genius and Weird Science.
Oh, that was a year.
And it has all of kind of the elements from all of those combined into one. It also has John Stockwell and Dennis Hopper in it, and also Fisher Stevens.
Oh, no.
Kids need to do a science project, so they grab some parts from an old junkyard, which just so happened to be a dumping ground for some alien technology.
Oh.
They plug it in and open wormholes in space and time, and things
Doesn't
start to come
Ethan
through.
Ethan Hawke in it?
I do not think it has Ethan Hawke in it.
Okay.
But I just remember Dennis Hopper jumping through the time portal rift and coming back later. Oh, man, I hung out at Woodstock, man. Blah. I'm talking about my science project. At the time, I thought it was a lot of fun because you're, you know, here are these kids in high school, and suddenly, you know, Washington is walking through the hallway, and the hall, another hallway turns into them being in Vietnam, and the gym is full of dinosaurs, that kind of stuff. But
I was
somebody.
Explorers,
let me just say, I know Explorers is probably another one, but somebody sent me a copy of this movie. Because I think the only place you can get it is maybe on VHS, maybe on DVD. It's certainly not online anywhere. And
they're like, Steven likes time travel.
Well, because I've been talking about my science project and not being able to find it in a digital format. So somebody sent it to me. And boy, oh boy. Oh boy. All the fun. This is the thing when we're talking about movies that we loved as kids, but that don't stand the test of time. It's like Rodrigo said, where, oh, you remember all these elements that were just awesome at the time. Mm-hmm. And then you sit down and watch and you're like, who the hell wrote this thing? Oh, Jonathan Buell wrote it. But oh my gosh.
Jonathan Bunuel. Louis Bunuel.
Yeah. And it's just like, what? And then I couldn't even finish the movie. I watched about 15 minutes of it. And it was so horrid. It had greasers and nerds teaming up together and the cute girl thing. And just doesn't work. Does not work anymore. And it's ruined a time travel movie for me. So. There you go.
You'll always
my have science project. Yeah, Real Genius is good. Weird Science is good.
Real Genius is wonderful. Real Genius is not a perfect movie by any means, but it's a damn fine outing for 1985.
Yep. 1985 is my science project. All right, yep. Rodrigo, what do you have for your number two?
My number two is a movie that, like Pre-Hysteria, I used to go and rent a lot and sit down and watch it. And it took me a long, long time to realize that this movie was actually just a huge ripoff, of a much better movie. And like every aspect of it was a ripoff. I'm talking about a movie that I think I've mentioned on the show before, or at least in the Major Spoilers podcast, Mac and Me.
Oh,
yeah, Mac and Me is like just a serious, serious ripoff of E.T. Like,
right.
To the point where the alien is called Mac,
yeah.
Which stands for Mysterious Alien Creature. Like, it, like, right down to the product placement, it's like there's Reese's Cups, all right? Like, Reese's Pieces all over E.T. There's, like, Coca-Cola all over Mac and Me. Like, it is just, like, so blow for blow, all the things that were good about E.T., except with like a quarter of the budget and like a quarter of the soul to it, you know? You know, some cool practical effects on it, but otherwise nothing more. And it's like having seen E.T. afterwards, just thinking like, man, that was so much of a better movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just in every way, it's just so much better. You know, it's just like, in the end, it's like, that's the thing. It's like movies that a lot of time, movies that you love as kids, you don't have that perspective, right? You don't know that something's being like hugely derivative. but and so you might think to yourself, well, who cares, right? But it's okay. Like, I enjoyed it as a kid and that's okay. But sometimes after expanding your views a little bit and going back to something, it just does not hold up. And Mac and Me, other than that time that I saw it in B-Fest back when I was in school, it really doesn't hold up.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah. It is the first movie work of Jennifer Aniston, however.
Really?
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, she's in that for like 12 seconds as an extra.
Well, there you go.
That's the first thing she ever did.
An interesting correlation, because I believe Courtney Cox was in Masters of the Universe. So
yep, she was.
Ah, so we found our secondary nexus of awful.
Yeah.
The cast of
She was also in Misfits of Science, yes. So
Misfits of Science, exactly. That's the problem.
All right, we are down to our number ones. These movies at the time probably were so awesome, so cool, but now we look at them and go, what? Mm-hmm. Matthew, your number one, please.
My number one. I think I have to give you a little bit of background, because this is number one. This is number one. This is the top of the charts. In 1877.
You weren't a kid.
There was an actual historical event called the Lincoln County War, which took place in the state of New Mexico and featured notable real personages, including one William H. Bonney, known as Billy the Kid. And they made a movie of this in 1988, featuring actors known to be part of a group colloquially referred to as the Brat Pack. And this film, Young Guns, is really well put together. It features General Zod, which is nice. It features the guy from Ripley's Believe It or Not, Lou Diamond Phillips playing another character of indistinct ethnicity, and that's fine. That's what Lou Diamond Phillips does. But in that movie, they took a few liberties, but kind of tried to keep to the real, actual historical events. And it ended with Billy the Kid having a little bit of a conflict with Pat Garrett, who in real life shot Billy the Kid, who was played by John Wayne's kid in that movie. That is not my number one. However, a couple of years later, they made a sequel. And my number one is Young Guns 2, which not only runs rampant over the quote-unquote legacy of the movie Young Guns, but actually changes historical events and negates the end of the movie. Because the end of Young Guns specifically states that years later, after William H. Bonney was killed, one of his lost friends slipped into the graveyard and carved one word in his headstone, and that word was PALS. Now, what this movie does is it says, oh, yeah, that happened. No, it didn't. Okay. But Young Guns 2 basically goes, the first one made some money, so let's go nuts and let's make sure that we throw in lots of people who are well known and you know, put in some Christian Slater and the guy from CSI. And what really happened in 1990 or 91 when I saw this movie in the theaters, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. This made me like Westerns for a while. This was the film that I'm like, Westerns are cool, doo-dee-doo. And there's a character in this movie who is played by Christian Slater, who in 1991, 1992, Christian Slater was one of my idols. I wanted to be Christian Slater if I ever grew up. I haven't yet, so theoretically I still can. But it's just not good. And if you watch it today, it is just a cavalcade of here's some actors, let's let them do their shtick and throw in a little fan service here and there and some cool moments, and just every single moment of it feels both inessential and show-offy at the same time. And when you get to the end of this movie, they actually do bring in another piece of actual history in the form of a guy from the 1949, 1950, who showed up and said, yeah, I was Billy the Kid. But the movie brings this character in as a framing sequence to explain what happened, and then ends with a thing that says, yeah, and he died 2 weeks later. So the most interesting part of the movie is just a throwaway line to set up a whole bunch of, you know, just showing off by Christian Slater and Cameron from Ferris Bueller, and just an hour and a half of why did they make another one? Ending the moment that makes you think that maybe Charlie Sheen isn't the only one of Martin's kids who's a little bit off his nut. But again, it's an actor playing a character and not the man himself. And Emilio, if you're listening, hi, we love you. Come on the show. Come talk to us.
We love you, Coach Bombay.
One, yeah, we love you, guy from that one thing.
Yeah, I also remember you from Garbage Men.
Let's go through Emilio's entire, just in case he's listening.
I think we just did. That's the sad part.
Oh, you lost him. We had him, and you lost him. I think he was in, like, the Outsiders or something. And oh, Free Jack. Don't forget Free Jack, where he fought Mick Jagger in the future in Free Jack. That's what it was. And there were like 9 Mighty Ducks movies, I think.
Yep.
Yes, he was in Numbers. Yeah, you got that. Thank you for that entirely helpful interruption of my work over here, for which I am working and doing official work-related work. My number one, Young Guns 2. It didn't hurt me as much as Star Trek. It didn't offend me as much as Revenge of the Nerds. But all together, it just, it's like more than the sum of its sucky parts, I think, is probably what it should be. But hey, Keith or Sutherland, you know.
Yeah, I remember you, too. Come on our show.
If you're listening, Kiefer, we loved you in everything. We loved you in Flatliners. We loved you as the 90s zombie with the pointy head. We loved you as Jack Bauer, the king of torture. We love you, Kiefer Sutherland.
Is he in Dark City?
Yes. Kiefer's good, man. Kiefer, you know.
We love you, 24.
Yes. And we love you too, Die Hard. If you're listening, we love you.
Yeah. Oh, man. I love that part of that scene where, like, 24 pulls out a gun and La Bamba's like, no, that's not how you do it. And then Mighty Ducks is like, shut up, you guys.
And La Bamba's having, like, a knife fight. But it turns out that Heathers is all like, no, we're going over here. Yeah, that was a good one.
Ah, oh, boy. Yes. Yes, there you go.
You know, Kiefer Sutherland, we did not love you in that movie where you were cowboys with Woody Harrelson, but everything else.
Wait, I loved you in that movie where you were a cowboy with Woody Harrelson.
White you don't even know jump. The name of that movie. Name that movie.
White Men Can't Jump.
No.
Oh.
That's okay, first of all.
Is that the one where he's wearing the hat on his wiener?
You're mistaking Kiefer Sutherland for Blade. Now, they had similar haircuts in Lost Boys and Blade and long, dark coats, so I can give you that. They were both vampires.
Yeah.
But, I don't even remember that. Wesley Snipes. Yeah, Wesley Snipes. Noxzema Jackson. So Noxzema Jackson was this vampire, right? And anyway.
All right, my number one. My number one is going to be super controversial, and I expect a lot of people will jump all over this.
You're wrong, Steven.
But it was, I'm sure that's what they'll say. It's my list, so there. But yeah. So this was a movie that hit me right at the right time. This was right at my demographic when this movie came out. It was a movie about adventure. It had a fairly diverse cast. It had pirates. And it was crazy. But then, what was it, the 40th anniversary of Goonies? No, it couldn't have been. 35th anniversary of Goonies came out. Not too long ago, and my wife and I were like, hey, I bet our son would like watching this movie. And so we sat down and we started to watch Goonies, and it is the worst mess ever.
You are the dead kids, to me, can opener.
The kids are yelling, and it's constant yelling and screaming for no reason. Just, throughout the entire movie. Yes, it has, at the time, I guess maybe we're more sensitive today, but man, the filthy, filthy mouths on these kids. And then it was just this weird, again, this weird production value where it should have been shot on location, but suddenly they're going down a flume slide at Waterworld. And Goonies just does not hold up today. There are so many plot holes in the movie. You sit there and watch it, and it's like, why is this happening? Why is this even being allowed to happen? And I'm sorry, but Goonies is a movie that I really loved as a kid, but today does not stand the test of time.
But it's got Joe Pantoliano.
Doesn't matter who it has in it. It's also got The Hobbit, and it's got the guy who played W. Josh Brolin is in it.
The Matrix and Goodfellas were in jail, right? And Throw Mama from the Train had to break them out. But it turns out that Edgar Frog and his friends, Short Round.
Not Short Round.
Oh, sorry.
It's not the same guy.
His friends, Temple of Doom and The Hobbit come, and they're going to break him out with the help of Jonah Hex.
Actually, it's Frodo. Yeah, it'd be Frodo, not Hobbit, Frodo. But yeah. But yeah, I mean,
still,
at the time, when you think about it, a lot of those kids that were in that went on to do some really amazing things and continue to do some really amazing things.
Yeah, but Raising Hope isn't.
But the structure of that movie and how they proceed from one plot point to another is just, first of all, half the movie doesn't make sense. Like, for example, they're walking through a tunnel that supposedly only one man found, you know, 50 years ago, and he died. And they're walking through the tunnel, and then suddenly there's the country club pipes hanging down from below, which, you know, if you broke through and you found this tunnel, you probably would have followed it all the way to One-Eyed Willy's treasure. But sorry, Goonies just doesn't work.
Hey, man, I'm there with you. I saw Goonies for the first time probably in my 20s, and I was like, what did I just watch? And it's like everybody else that I knew, even people my age, because Goonies is like a little bit.
Yeah, I was 14 maybe when did that movie come out?
Yeah, so it's like for, you know, for us, like, but we got introduced to Goonies, or my friends got introduced to Goonies through like older brothers you know, uncles, or just having it on TV when you're a kid. So it's like, but I never did. So it's like watching it as an adult, I was like, no, this isn't a good movie. And everybody just like would always jump down my throat about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know why? Because the Goonies are good enough.
Well, maybe for you, but not for me.
And, you know, it's not
they've got a great song. With you know, Time After Time, Time After Time is singing the song.
They should have given that song to Papa Don't Preach. I think she would have given it a little more soul.
When you think about it, look at all the names that came out of Goonies. Sean Astin, mm-hmm. Josh Brolin, Jeff Cohen, mm-hmm. Corey Feldman.
It's Jeff Cohen.
You may remember him from such movies as She's the Sheriff,
Goonies,
Family Ties, Perfect Harmony. Looks like his last bit of work was 1991.
Oh, was that the fat kid?
Yes, that was the fat kid. That was Chunk.
Yeah.
Corey Feldman,
Chunk
as we already mentioned.
Grew up to be a perfectly well-adjusted lawyer.
Yeah, normal
guy.
Yeah. Cary Green, who was in Lucas. A lot of people remember her from Lucas. That was, I think, her... Oh, she was in Summer Rental, too. Martha Plimpton.
Yeah.
As you said...
Ki Wai Kwan.
Joe Pantoliano. Mm-hmm. Ann Ramsey. A lot of so many really big names in that movie. It's just a shame that it does not hold up today. Anyway, Rodrigo, now it's on to your number one, the final one tonight or today, whenever you're listening. Hello, future people. How are you?
Hello, future people.
So my number one is one that I watched a lot, and it's... because it's a sequel, and it's fun to watch sequels after you watch the original. But even then, especially if you watch the original and this one back to back, you just see the production values just dip so hard. this is, of course, I'm referring to The Return of Jafar, aka Aladdin, The Return of Jafar. And there's a lot of problems with this one. You know, Aladdin was pretty tight. There's some issues with it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that I think even as a kid, I was like, wait a minute. He didn't wish to pretend to be a prince. He wished to be a prince. So there's a ton of desert out there. Just make him a plot of land and now he's a prince. What's the problem, right? Whatever. Fine. Let's not get into that. But The Return of Jafar has like even more plot holes. Like all of the... rules for genies get like thrown out the window, and they get very quickly lampshaded as they're going out the window, but it's not in a very satisfying way, right? It's like Jafar can't be a threatening bad guy if he can't kill people as a genie, or if he relies on people wishing for him to do anything as a genie, right? For some reason, he's a very autonomous genie. But what are you going to do?
Wasn't this movie heavily also featured Up All Night in it? And kind of ruin that whole thing, Iago.
Well, here's the thing. Here's what The Return of Jafar actually is. The Return of Jafar is the pilot for the Aladdin
mm-hmm.
animated series.
Yeah. Jason Alexander. Oh, I'm sorry. See, if I say Seinfeld, then it's just going to be Seinfeld, but then you're going to be confused. Anyway, yeah, Jason Alexander is, he was in the show afterwards, and that's the first appearance of that character. Like, a lot of stuff is set up, like the fact that Iago is basically part of the party in mm-hmm. the show, that's all set up in The Return of Jafar. The Return of Jafar is the pilot, and it has Disney afternoon production values, mm-hmm. which is like... Mm-hmm. So jarring to go from one to the other. I don't know if you guys ever saw Aladdin and the King of Thieves.
I watched probably about half of it before I got turned off on it.
So I don't think Aladdin I've seen any of the sequels, really.
Aladdin and the King of Thieves has better production value than The Return of Jafar. It was made to kind of be the end, even after the series had already ended, I think,
almost 6 months or something like that. Yeah, it's about a year.
It was made to be the end cap to the Aladdin animated series. And then that one just came across a lot better because it was like this higher production value end to this actually like super long series. The Aladdin animated series was on for several seasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like looking back at The Return of Jafar, there's just so many things about it that I'm like, that is terrible. Most of the cast came back for it. You know, it's like everyone.
They replaced Patch Adams with The Simpsons, though.
Yep, they did. So basically everyone except for Dead Poets Society was back.
Right.
And, you know, so it's good. It's a Disney movie. It's a sequel to a strong movie. Like, there was no reason why it had to be as crappy as it was, and it is just kind of crappy in general. It just seemed like really thrown together. Mm-hmm. So my number one, just kind of a big disappointment, is The Return of Jafar.
Yeah. Apparently Mork and Mindy left in his will that there are certain things that they still can't do with Aladdin that they want to do with his character that he's prohibited in his will.
Wow.
Which is really weird. Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, that's a bitter long dispute.
Well, Mrs. Doubtfire had some very strong feelings about the way the character was used. So you have to give the man props for standing by his guns.
Yeah, you definitely do. All right, everybody, that wraps it up for our top five movies that we loved as kids but didn't stand the test of time. Here's what you need to do. Head over to majorspoilers.com. There's a link right there in the show notes. You can click on it on your mobile device. We'll take you right over there, scroll down to the comment section, and share your top five movies that you loved as a kid but just didn't stand up today if you watched them. It could be because of production value. It could be because of bad acting. It could be because of any number of things. But tell us why it doesn't stand the test of time for you. Could be because of 24. Yeah, definitely. I think that's all the move. Flatliners. Did we mention
Flatliners?
That one? I don't remember.
He was in everything, dude.
Yeah, during that time period.
He's been in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's someone who has stood the test of time. All right, everybody. That wraps it up for this installment. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. And remember, until next time, everybody loves a list.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.